Chapter 27. Okinawa. Iwo Jima was the key. It opened the door to the invasion of Japan and the end of the Pacific War. B-29s from Guam and Saipan passed over Iwo Jima without being attacked. Dozens and dozens of planes used Sulphur Island as an emergency landing field on their way back from bombing Japan. On the islands of Japan, many people wished the war to end. There were plenty of people who hadn't wanted their country to go to war with the United States. As more of their loved ones died on faraway islands, many Japanese people saw that nothing was possible but defeat. The Imperial Command, however, was still led by military men who refused to accept surrender. The war had to go on. So once again, we code talkers took part in another invasion. About 50 of us were part of the operation. We were called Operation Iceberg. Our 1,600 ships were the largest armada in history, and the number of our troops was even bigger than the force that landed on the beaches of Normandy in Europe. I was now with the 6th Division, made up of regiments from other disbanded divisions. This time we were to invade the island of Okinawa, even closer to Japan. The Okinawan people had always been peaceful and had no history of ever going to war. But when the Japanese took over their island, our enemies made it into another military fortress. Our carriers went first, sending planes against the Okinawan airfields. Many enemy aircraft were destroyed on the grounds, but others took off to attack our ships. Kamikaze planes fell out of the sky toward our carriers. Those swarms of small planes looked to me like wasps whose nests had been poked by a stick. Many were shot down, and just as many fell into the sea without hitting any target. A lot of those planes were piloted by young men who'd never flown before. They were allowed to get drunk before taking off, since it would be their last drink. Too many of those planes did strike their targets. The Hornet and the Franklin were hit the hardest. Over 700 men died on the Franklin. I saw it burning right next to me as our invasion force steamed on. In addition to my Navajo buddies, two of my white friends who had survived the other campaigns were there with me. Of course, one of them was Smitty, who was stuck to my side like a burr. Who was the other one? One of the greatest surprises I have ever had in my life came just after we left port for Okinawa. As I stood by the rail, a familiar drawling voice spoke up next to me. "Hey, Chief, what are y'all gonna do when y'all see one of them habu snakes? I hear there's just a crawling all over Okinawa." It was Georgia Boy. He had survived his wounds. There was a big bandage on his neck, but an even bigger smile on his face. I hugged him so hard that for once I was the one who lifted him off his feet and almost cracked his ribs. Then the deck shifted as the ship turned, and we both almost went over the rail. Smitty, though, grabbed us and pulled us back. The three of us stood there laughing our heads off. "Why aren't you dead, you good-for-nothing redneck?" Smitty said. "Can't kill a cracker with just one little Jap bullet," Georgia Boyd answered, grinning. We weren't the only ones grinning. The mood on board our ships was really good. Even Radio Tokyo, still broadcasting its usual mixture of American music, bold-faced lies, and threats, brought a smile to most people's faces. "This is the Zero Hour, boys. It is broadcast for all you American fighting men in the Pacific, particularly those standing off the shores of Okinawa, because many of you will never hear another program. Here's a nice number for you. Going home. It's nice work if you can get it." There was a time when ominous words like those from Tokyo Rose had made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. Now, those broadcasts just amused me. Most of us Marines were spending more time joking and talking about how the war had to end soon than worrying about the impending battle. "What are you going to do when you get home, Chief?" Smitty asked me. "He's going to eat mutton," Georgia Boy said, chuckling. "Me," Smitty said, "I'm going back to college. That GI Bill is going to give me a free education." I didn't answer them. Much as I wanted to go home, deep in my heart it was still hard for me to believe that the war was almost over. Okinawa still lay ahead of us, and then the other islands of Japan. April 1st was landing day on Okinawa. It was also Easter Sunday. 154,000 of us GIs and Marines were poised to hit the Hagushi beaches. As I climbed into my boat, my stomach felt tight as a drum. Would this be like it was on Iwo Jima? Once again, as the boat powered through the waves, there was no enemy fire at all. All that greeted me as I stepped out onto the rocky shore was a gentle wind. I dreaded what would happen next. Would it be another ambush as soon as enough of us were ashore? But as more and more men came out of the water, there was still no resistance at all. Hour after hour passed. The only thing that broke the quiet was the roar of amphibious tanks. Before long, all of us were calling that day by a new name. "This ain't landing day," George Boy said, as we sat watching more and more troops and equipment follow us up onto the beach. "This here is Love Day. Taking this here place gonna be as easy for us as it was for my Yankees to win the series in 43. "Hey, George Boy," Smitty said, "you ever hear this song?" Then he began whistling "Meet Me in St. Louis." It made us all chuckle, even Georgia Boy. That past October, the Yankees hadn't even made it to the World Series. It turned out to be a Missouri special, with the St. Louis Cardinals winning in 4 over the St. Louis Browns. By nightfall, we'd already reached objectives that were supposed to have taken days. Bulldozers were clearing away the wreckage of Japanese planes on Yontan Airfield. It all seemed too easy. And it was. On April 8th, we hit Kakazu Ridge. The Japanese soldiers had pulled back and dug in to wait for us. Their first line of defense was a long, rocky ridge, heavily fortified, but so camouflaged that we didn't know it was there. Their plan was to hold us off at their defense lines, to be the rock that would break the sword of our attack. The Japanese Imperial General Headquarters wanted to bleed us white. They hoped that so many Americans would die, we'd lose heart and stop our attacks. That was the idea of one of their best military men, General Ushijima, and it almost worked. I don't mean that we almost gave up, but it took a long time and we lost so many good men. Our battle for Okinawa was some of the bloodiest fighting in the war. It was made even harder because there were no good roads and the island was crossed by ranges of hills running from east to west. We had to fight from one ridge to the next. It seemed it would never end. I have spoken so much about other battles I saw that I will say little more about Okinawa than that it took us 83 days. The island was finally declared secure on June 2, 1945. On that same day, General Ushijima committed suicide. 12,000 Americans were dead or missing. 36 of our smaller ships had been sunk by the kamikazes, and about 400 more had been damaged by the attacks. The Japanese had lost 3,600 airplanes and 110,000 men. 80,000 Okinawan civilians also died in the battles. Through it all, our Navajo code was used to send and receive messages. We Navajos had helped a lot, but rather than feeling glad about it, I had a great heaviness in my heart. If it cost this much to take just one small island, invading the big islands of Japan would be too terrible to imagine. Our commanders now estimated there'd be at least 1 million American casualties. No one knew how many Japanese soldiers and civilians would die. Thousands of kamikaze planes, suicide boats, human torpedoes, and midget submarines had been prepared by our enemies. Tens of millions of Japanese would give their lives to defend their homeland. All our intelligence said that the Japanese military was still not ready to quit, even though the ordinary people were desperate for peace. Although I didn't know it at the time, grandchildren, all through the war, many Japanese citizens were imprisoned or murdered because they spoke out against it. There was a powerful military organization called the Thought Police in Japan. If you were suspected of even thinking about criticizing the government, you'd be taken away by the Thought Police. It was also hard for the Japanese to speak up because they believed that their emperor was a god, the son of the sun god. They had to do what they were told because their emperor could do no wrong. Some brave Japanese people tried to let their emperor know how they felt. There were some men whose sons had died during the war, who chose a certain way to tell their emperor there had been enough sacrifice. They did so through a sacrifice of their own. First it was only a few, but by the last year of the war, there were many. Each grieving father sent a small package, carefully wrapped, to the imperial palace. None of those packages ever reached the emperor. They were quickly disposed of by men who'd been appointed to keep all bad news from reaching Emperor Hirohito. Each package contained the sender's right index finger. It seems that Emperor Hirohito didn't know what was truly happening much of the time. Any Japanese defeat was too embarrassing for the military leaders to admit to their immediate superiors, much less to their divine emperor. The real power in Japan during World War II was held by the Supreme Military Council, who assured the emperor that their decisions were best for their nation. While we kept secrets from our enemies kept secrets from each other, lying to their own people about what was truly happening. One of the saddest messages we code talkers ever received came on April 12, 1945. As soon as I got it on my radio, I took off my headphones. I couldn't talk. My throat was choked up, and my eyes were filled with tears. Johnny Manuelito was my partner in the radio room that day. He put his hand on my shoulder. "What is it?" he asked. "Our FDR is gone," I finally managed to answer in a choked voice. "The President of the United States has died." It was a great shock to everyone. Few people knew how sick President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had been. Now everybody knows too much about everyone, even the personal lives of our leaders. Back then, though, things like that were kept private. Many Americans didn't even know President Roosevelt was crippled by polio. Roosevelt had been our president for more than 3 terms in office. People loved and trusted him. On the decks of ships and on the shores of Pacific Islands, Marines, sailors, and soldiers knelt and wept together in prayer services for our fallen president. That morning, when I offered pollen, I prayed for his family and those who loved him. I'll tell you one story about Okinawa, grandchildren. It was one of my best memories of the whole war. A group of us code talkers had been able to catch a goat. We butchered it and cooked it over a fire. It was almost as good as mutton. Its smell brought other Indians. One of them was my Cheyenne buddy from Iwo Jima, Sam Littlefingernail, who is now a scout with the 6th. As he cut off a piece of that goat, he began to smile. "This makes me think of a story my Lakota great-grandpa told me," he said. "He was in the big fight when we wiped out Custer. But halfway through the battle, he rode over a hill and there were 2 other Lakotas sitting around a fire cooking meat. They had just killed a buffalo. So the 3 of them sat around eating buffalo steak before going back into the fight." "Good story," I said. "Now pass me some of that buffalo mutton." We all laughed and laughed. For a time, on that faraway island, we were just Indians sitting around a fire and eating. It was like the old days, long before any white man's war.